Okay, what I'm going to talk today is about the structure of dark matter halos, and this is there any pointer here? Yeah. It's basically a collaboration with a former student of mine, Andreas Faltenbacher, who is now in Santa Cruz with Anatoly Klypin, with Andrei Kravtsov, and his student Akrio, with Jan Mückert and his former student Matthias, with Gustavo and the former student of Gustavo, Jaco Askarziba. And I mean, I am prepared to speak 20 minutes because this was the original idea. So I took it as short as possible without any large introduction after the experience of the last week. And but anyway, I want to come back at least for a couple of minutes to the discussion what we had last week for those people who participated in this discussion. This was basically what Gustavo has shown, the mass function of the dark matter halos, now in that form that you can understand it immediately. That means you have a total mass here, and you have again the total mass, but now in red only of those halos which really include stars. So there's none of this shifting, but you see that starting approximately here at the several 10 to the 9 solar masses, we are starting to get halos without stars at all, halos without light. And if I go now back basically to that picture what Gustavo has shown last week, now in a little bit other manner, now we have again the mass function, the total mass function, the same as here, but now we show here something what you could call mass function of the stellar content of those halos, and with another x-axis. So the x-axis is here shifted by the baryon content. So you would expect if all these halos form approximately the same percentage of stars, you would expect that this curve is basically parallel here and goes then to the left if you don't have stars. What you see is that it starts with a high percentage of baryons going over and stars, and then decreasing all the time until here, where you don't have any stars anymore. So from that point of view, this picture is also interesting because it has a lot of information inside, but slightly different information. And in principle, you have to read it in this direction. So you have a mass function of your halos, and you can compare and say, okay, how many stars would I have in these halos? And from this, you can learn that with decreasing mass, you have less and less luminosity, because less and smaller amount of stars here in those halos. This is from simulations. I mean, sorry, you haven't been here, so I don't want to go back and to explain again with simulation what Gustavo did last week. It was only he had shown this plot, and in order to clarify it a little bit, I wanted to show this one. The mass resolution, it is an 80 megaparsec box, and this is from a 50 megaparsec box with 2,000 cube particles in the void region. So I don't remember exactly what was. Do you remember several times 10 to the 6? But it is a void region selected in a 50 megaparsec box, and that region is resimulated with 2,000 cube particles formally distributed over the whole box. So before starting now, yeah, that's excellent because I'm... Okay, I guess the speaker has to finish the pizza later on. Let me start. So, what I want to talk is about the structure, the inner structure of galaxy clusters, and This project has been introduced already by Gustavo last week. So what we did, basically, we took a box of 80 megaparsec, and when we have selected in this box a number of clusters, 15 in total, and have re-simulated all these clusters with high resolution or even with very high resolution, that means with 500 or 1,000 cube particles. And in the same box, we have selected region of lower density voids. But this is another story. This was something what Gustavo told already about. And several people have then analyzed those simulations. And what I want to talk about is something about the inner structure, the inner profile of the cluster, what we have found here. And one, this is the famous cluster of all, which is in my terminology, the cluster number 6, and in the terminology of Andrei Kravtsov, number 2, and I think you use also the number 2 because this is the second massive one. And so it's a cluster of about 2 times 10 to the 14 solar masses, which hit right now at a redshift of 0.6, a major merger. And it's quite interesting that during this merger, the main axis of a central part of the cluster shifted directly in this direction. This is something what we have also studied, how the main axis of the clusters are related to the environment. So if you have these rapid changes, you would probably also expect that during evolution, the inner profile of the cluster could change. Coming now to the inner profile of the cluster, this is again one of the examples. It's exactly this one what we have seen in the movie now. It got the number 2. And what you see here is the profile, the density profile of this cluster 2 times, shifted by a factor of 10. And when we try to fit any of these famous density profiles, Navarro, Frank White, Moore, or Jing and Suto, which differ a little bit in the inner and in the outer part. And those density profiles have been fitted here using 2 different methods. The upper fits are used by a chi-square, and the lower fits by a maximum deviation method. So you see, first of all, that the fits differ slightly, and you see that the difference between the fit and the real potential is also different. So in that case, you underestimate the inner part. Here, you have a better fitting of the inner part, but you overestimate a large part of a cluster by some 20%. So the conclusion from that is that it is very difficult in principle to fit such a real cluster potential with one of those 3 fits. So, and moreover, in the inner part, I mean, here the best fit according to these 2 methods would be Jing and Suto, and you would get something like 0.5 minus 0.5 in the inner part. And if you calculate the slope only in the inner part, you get also something around of 0.5. But all these problems arise here because, in principle, the slope is noisy, and it is noisy because, as you have seen in this movie, there's a lot of substructure moving all the time. And so, for the high square fitting, in principle, this is the deviation inside of the bins. So you calculate the deviation of, I mean, what you are what you have you calculate the summary of the deviation of all particles in that bin from the spread. Yeah. Okay, if you do that, you get for all these clusters which are in our sample different best fits, which you can use, and you can moreover estimate an inner slope for all these clusters. And you see that there's a wide spread over this over the inner slopes of this cluster, starting from some minimum of 0.23 to a maximum of -2. And again, if you now look to this picture, which has already been shown by Anatoly, you see that this is an enlargement of the picture. If you go to the very inner part, there are differences between these two realizations. One realization is with 512 cube particles, the other is with 1024 cube particles, formal resolution at region. So you can go a little bit more inside if you have more mass resolution. But on the other hand, you see that again, there are differences which are not very well seen here in this plot, but which you could again obtain from here. So the question, if you look on it, there seems to be a tendency that there is a flattening here, and there is another flattening in the high resolution, and on different scales. So the flattening occurs a little bit earlier here than here. So if you look to that picture, you see correspondingly you have here some mountain, and then it goes deeper in this part. So the question is, first of all, is this flattening due to resolution? And the second question is, what is the final inner slope, what we would obtain if we would have some kind of infinite resolution? So does it reduce the slope more and more from the measured -1.2 or so here to smaller and smaller values, or is there somewhere an end?
I thought their slope internally, that it's always flatter than any of your clusters. So in fact, in one case, where it doesn't matter, it's spontaneous.
Yeah. Or so. I mean, I will come to this problem at the end for a moment. This is some kind of a project what we have to measure too. So the next question is there any evolution of that profile? So there was a discussion last Thursday when Anatoly gave his talk about evolution or not evolution of the profile. I'm not sure. If we look again for that cluster, we see that the profile changes with time. So unfortunately, this is something what Andreas did, and I somehow did not manage to run it a little bit slowlier. But what you see here is the profile of this cluster measured between redshift 1 and redshift 0, and you see infalling objects, infalling galaxies. You see that the slope changes here pretty much. You see that it changes also in the inner part, at least for a short moment, if something is going in. And this is what you would expect also. I mean, if you had a look to a movie, you could see that there is one clump going directly through the center, leaving it on the other side and coming back. And basically, this is what you see also here in that infra. So what you would expect is that the profile of this cluster should somehow depend on at least the inner profile should depend on the recent merging history. If there is right now in that moment a merger, you would probably measure a completely different inner profile, but you wouldn't see it. Because, I mean, you can see easily a merger if the object is far away, but in the moment, if it is going through the very center, you wouldn't see it in the simulation and also not in observation.
So what's the time scale between the major accretion events there?
Between what?
Well, I mean, if you see these little big bumps that propagate through when you accrete a big blob of material, I assume. But
I mean,
what's the time between the
largest plump which is aggregated, this is what we have seen in the movie, is at 0.6. And the smaller clumps, I cannot say how many, I never measured how many clumps are really going nearby the center during that time. I mean, the total amount of substructure in terms of the number of halos above 100 particles is several hundred. And not all of them are moving on central orbits. Only if you move on central orbits, you would see something like this incoming wave. Yeah, what I said. There's one major, in that case, there's one major merger at 0.6, and another clump is falling in right now and is on a distance of 200 or so kiloparsec. But the question is, what is a major merger?
I mean, it looks like there's a pretty significant bump in the profile, maybe
20 or 25
degrees.
Yeah, but this is the outer part. Look, this is around, it goes out up to 1.5 megaparsec. So it's basically what you see here is this elliptical movement of the smaller halos. This is what you see all the time here, and sometimes something is running inside. And this is basically only this one big cluster. Somehow I'm running out of time also completely. Anyway, so this is now an attempt to measure the inner structure of these clusters in a slightly different way. So what I have shown here is the density profile again, together with the potential, is just integrated over the masses and normalized so that it is zero in the inner part. And this, or here on this side, you have the units. And when I have the radial velocity dispersion.
It's here, okay. So now the first term does, here is the lattice data. The first term does do reasonably well. It is this guy here, okay. The second term is really very nasty. He makes the result go up. The third term makes it a little better. The fourth term makes it a little better, this one here. And then what the Finns did was to say, we have computed this, and we are going to guess values for this. And
okay, it's basically this one I wanted to say. So we have computed this, and we got basically this. This is the anisotropy parameter, and what you see is that that you see basically the same general behavior for a galactic scale or a cluster scale halo, but you should notice that there are different units here on the right hand side. So this is the upper part, and now we go to the lower part of this plot, and here we have plotted the circular velocity as it is calculated directly from the Jeans equation with and without an isotropy parameter and as it is calculated or measured, if you want, so from the simulation. So what you see is that there is a good agreement between the measured and the calculated circular velocity, and this is a hint that you can describe these kind of halos with a Jeans equation. This is a hint that these halos are enough relaxed, and you can use the Jeans equation to describe it. And with that knowledge, we go back to this potential distribution and try to find a fit for the potential distribution over the whole scale. And then we want to calculate the resulting density distribution. The idea behind this is that we believe that the distribution of a potential is on a longer scale described by some kind of inner in a profile over a large distance. If you believe that, and if you try to make an ansatz, this ansatz should be something of that kind. I mean, you need here a power of k for the inner part, and k should be smaller than 1 to avoid any problems with infinite masses. And on the outer part, it should go back to the measured potential if the halo goes over into the background. So basically, this was the idea behind of this ansatz, and the potential is again, as in the first plot, normalized to be 0 in the center of that. So we assume that it is a pretty well description here, and we have measured this k parameter, and you see that this k parameter differs not very much between all these halos. If you assume that this is a good description, you can insert this ansatz into the Jeans equation. And from the first test, we have seen that the Jeans equation seems to describe all these halos quite well. And after that, you get this expression from which you can again learn, as it was already an assumption, that k should be smaller than 1. Otherwise, you get problems with that term here. So you get rid of it, of that term, if k is substantially small. And if you insert it then again into the Poisson equation, you can calculate for the inner. Always what I'm telling now is about the inner, an approximation in the inner part of the halo. You get something like a prediction for the density profile, which is directly connected to this one. So our experience from our simulation is that it seems to be easier to measure this parameter because it seems to change not as rapidly as the density profile over large scales inside of the cluster. If you follow this assumption, you immediately end up with a prediction of an inner density slope which is related to that, and with a mean value of 0.41, what we found over all our simulations, you end up with a prediction that the inner slope should end somewhere in the region of minus 0.6, well below that what we have measured. So we have measured it down to minus 1 and got the impression. So the whole story here depends, of course, on how relaxed the cross clusters are, so whether it is possible to make this description what I made, and how well you can measure the k parameter from your simulations. So this is one part of the story, and this is basically was published this year. And since that is a workshop, I wanted to say something of what I am doing really now here during the workshop. This is some kind of outlook. So what we were talking about now is the structure of dark matter halos. But all of you know that there are something more. And this is that what we have introduced now artificially into these dark matter halos. So all of guys of you, or most of you, try to run huge simulations with gas dynamics and everything. And we tried in this moment to avoid all the gas dynamics, but put ready stars into this kind of simulation. How can you do it? You just select a number of dark matter particles in this simulation at a certain moment and call them stars and start to cool them so that they form disks. The basic idea behind, I mean, as long as you do it for one halo, you will not see, you will not get very interesting results probably. But the whole idea behind is that this is computational much less expensive, and you can start to run this simulation with many galaxies, with many dark matter halos, and with many disks, and see then what happens, how the distribution is, for example, changed in a cluster of galaxies if you have, instead of a dark matter halo with a standard NFW profile, something which has a much more pronounced center. And of course, if you measure now the density profiles, first result is that you have something like adiabatic compression. You have these now baryons or stars particles inside, and dark matter particles falling into the potential well of that. And second result is that it is too deep, it is too strongly concentrated. This is some other expression for this overcooling problem. We have too many, if we take it randomly from here, we have too many particles with too low angular momentum which end up in the very center. So we have in the very center a very sharp increasing density profile. But still, as I told you, this is something that is going under. So in the last picture you had seen this small substructure which ended up now in this disk. These units are kiloparsecs, Kuhn-Moffin kiloparsecs, so that everything is at a redshift of 1 point something. So it is by a factor 2 smaller, and this is by a factor 4 smaller than this. So what you see here is really the inner part, and the z-axis is parallel to the angular momentum of a whole halo. So this is basically what we want to do. If you look now into a larger region, out to one megaparsec, you see a number of dark matter halos, and in each of these dark matter halos, you see these tiny central regions. So you have, for the large, which is better resolved, and for this reason you can see it better, you have this disk inside the center, and you have other disks here somewhere outside. Still a test run with only a few thousand, 200,000 particles. So this is something which is in progress.
So can you tell it again, how you select the particles, or that the one just
randomly?
So they could be located anywhere.
We could be in the cluster. In the halo. So what we do, at a certain time moment, we define halos using a halo finder. Then we select randomly a certain percentage of both particles inside of these halos and start to cool them, preserving the angular momentum. And when one of the results is, again, that you, if you have a disk, if you have a halo with a small lambda parameter with a small spin parameter, you tend to get not such a nice disk as we have seen, but something which is more spherical. And cooling means basically reduction of velocity, preserving the angular momentum.
So we
reduce the radial, and we set, I mean, we calculate in which direction the angular momentum is, and of a halo, of a dark matter halo, of this guy. When we select particles and say those particles will be our baryons or stars. And when we start to cool them, and cooling means in that case we reduce the radial, this velocity, and we reduce the velocity in that direction.
Yeah,
to
the question was, do you reduce, do you have the same reduction for all the particles, same one,
correct? The same one, which is defined on the basis of a given halo. So the size of a halo goes into that, and but it's the same, basically the same cooling factor, which is of the order 100 or 50 or something. So the total reduction is by that factor, and we distribute it over approximately two dynamical times. So we don't do it in one time step, otherwise it collapses completely and flies around. So, but we do it step by step over two dynamical times. Always at each step calculating again the angular momentum and doing when as described briefly. But still.
So the part we randomly select is probably an angular momentum is pointing everywhere.
Yeah,
and then you impose it at the angle of the angular momentum, the same direction.
Yeah.
So where is the difference of angular momentum going to? It's lost. So you're not conserving.
No, I'm conserving the total angular momentum. I don't conserve the angular momentum of a single particle. To the other particles. I mean, if it, the summary angular momentum of the cooled particles is conserved. Oh, no. Yeah, basically this one. No, no. I mean, you calculate the total angular momentum of all these cooled particles. If you now reduce one velocity component, you shift, of course, the angular momentum of a given particle. But at the end, the total angular momentum of all these cooled particles is preserved. So if you do a box around the whole stuff, there is no angular momentum loss.
So if you check that at the end, the angular momentum is conserved, but it increases significantly from the stars to the dark matter.
No, it is redistributed within these stars to a certain accuracy.
So you do not transfer between star and dark matter?
No. I mean, the basic idea behind this just to reduce the velocities in a manner that the total angular momentum is constant, which works only if you have substantial enough particles. I mean, otherwise it's not good. Okay. So, as I told you, this is something which is not yet ready, and I was thinking for a long time whether I should talk about this here in that moment. I mean, I can talk to you about this stupid camera and these things, and everybody can hear it, and maybe in some time we see that it's not the best way how we did it. For our simulations, not yet.
So you can measure, because you have this, you can measure the actual rotation.
Yeah.
Compare that with the one that you would think that
We are now in the stage of a first or second test run. So we will do something. And another possibility, because you mentioned that, this is what we try, or we have started a project and it's not yet clear whether we get money. So this is again this famous cluster 6 in the high resolution, and we want to test now whether we can, using lensing methods, whether we can really measure the inner part of this cluster looking into different direction. And since this is not an isolated cluster but we have all the filaments around, we want to do that. And this is just a sequence of pictures we did for a short presentation, which you could share with me. You see that within, so what I do here, or what we did here, is putting a source in an increasing distance of that cluster, and you see increasing number of lensed rings here, and you see this radial arcs and these circular arcs, and you see also objects which are in the not really in the center, some substructures. And the idea behind of that is, and this is again only a starting point of a project, we don't have money to do it in the moment, but hope to get it. And then there would be a possibility to measure in the simulations again, to get an idea what you could really see under best conditions. I mean, if you when observers go to real world, it becomes worse in any case, but we wanted to see whether we could measure differences with these methods coming from our simulations. So, somehow I did it longer. That's it. I think I'm